Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Workforce and Business Development, Finance and Policy Committee. I'd like to call the committee to order. With that, I just wanted to notify members and guests and testifiers to mute their mics as we discuss, and only the time that when you're called on, then you should be able to unmute. This hearing is being conducted pursuant to Rule 10.01. This remote hearing can also be viewed on the House webcast. With that, I'd like to call the Committee Legislative Assistant, Mr. Badru, to now take the role.
Chair Noor.
Present.
Chair Noor present. Vice Chair Zhang.
Here.
Vice Chair Zhang present. Lead Hamilton.
Hamilton present.
Lead Hamilton present. Baker.
Baker present.
Baker present. Daphne.
Daphne present.
Daphne present. Frankie.
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Greenman.
Greenman present.
Greenman present. Haley. Haley. Juergens.
Juergens present.
Juergens present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Katiza Watun.
Present.
Katiza Watun present. Olson.
Present.
Olson present. Zhang.
Present.
Zhang present. Haley. Haley. Chair Noor, we have a quorum.
Members, there's a quorum present. With that, Lead Hamilton, I'm sure you have reviewed the minutes. Do you want to move the minutes for March 11th?
Yes, thank you. So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Lead Hamilton moves the approval for minutes for March 11, 2022. Any discussion, members? Any discussion? See none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed? See none. The minutes for March 11, 2022 are now approved. Members, we do have one bill and then also the deed budget request presentation from the department. So without any delay, I would like to invite Representative Breyer. I move your motion, House File 3321, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Please introduce your bill to the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. I'm here today to talk about House File 3321, a bill that provides an appropriation of $100,000 to the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership Program. This is a one-time appropriation that will be administered by deed through the Adult Career Pathways Program, and that has strong bipartisan support, including Senate authorship by Senator Housley and Representatives Baker, Hamilton, and Frankie in the House also as co-authors. Before I talk more about the program, please imagine yourself as a person who for years, maybe decades, has been caring for your family at home, dependent on another person's income. Then picture how you'd feel when that income is suddenly taken away through death, divorce, or other personal loss. Maybe you've never worked outside the home and suddenly your whole life has changed. This is traumatic and terrifying. Yet for many, literally thousands of people, tens of thousands of people over 40 plus years, the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership has stepped in to help. The program provides a combination of activities, including one-to-one self-sufficiency counseling, weekly workshop series, and coordination with other service providers. It's the only program in the state specifically designed to help displaced homemakers address the unique barriers they face while trying to enter or re-enter the workplace. Let me tell you about the people that MSRP has helped. According to the data from the most recent fiscal year, 97% of the participants are female, and 32% identify as BIPOC. 60% of displaced homemakers served by the program were victims of domestic violence. Of the participants with a child support order, 75% of them were not getting the court-ordered child support. 22% entered the program homeless. This program serves a population facing multiple barriers to self-sufficiency. MFRP's services result in excellent outcomes. 97% of participants successfully complete the program by attaining the goals they've set at intake, which include completing an individualized self-sufficiency plan that demonstrates stability, pursuing a degree or certificate program, and or becoming employed. You may be wondering how a relatively modest appropriation of $100,000 will help. MFRP has been primarily funded through fees since its inception. This funding has been falling short in recent years and had a major hit due to COVID. I'm grateful for the $225,000 funding provided each year of this biennium that has helped fill that COVID-driven gap. This year, in addition to the bill before us today, we're also bringing a bill forward to restructure the fees to bring the program to a self-sustaining level. This $100,000 is a bridge to cover some costs while the fee income stabilizes, and that other bill will be heard in judiciary tomorrow. With that, I'll be glad to take your questions, look forward to hearing from our testifiers, and ask for your support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Raya, for the presentation on that bill. I have Jean Keenan as a testifier. Please welcome to the committee, introduce yourself, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Jean Keenan, and I'm a provider in the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership. Thank you for this opportunity. I would also like to thank Representative Ryer for authoring the bill before you today and for simultaneously working with us to update the statutes related to base program funding. Thank you also to our supporting authors. As you may remember, the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership is a statewide network of six service providers offering family stabilization and pre-employment services. As Representative Ryer stated, our services support individuals who need to enter the workforce due to abandonment, divorce, disability, or death of a spouse or partner. It is our goal to interrupt the downward spiral that participants often face after the loss of a family's primary wage earner. Every low-income participant diverted from public assistance saves the state $19,181 annually per family consisting of one adult and two children. This wraparound program is offered at no cost to participants. Each individual works with a provider to develop a unique action plan. We teach participants the essential transferable skills they will need and help them develop effective job search strategies. Finally, and I think most importantly, the program helps families stabilize after a crisis by providing holistic and trauma-informed care. Funding for the program is authorized by statute and administered through deed from a portion of marriage license and divorce filing fees. This structure was specifically designed for this program. We are currently working to update that statute for the first time ever. However, because there will be a lag between collection and distribution of the funds to the program, we are requesting this one-time modest direct appropriation as bridge funding. As you may remember, the program suffered a nearly 25% clawback in funding last year due to fewer marriage licenses being requested during the pandemic. We are receiving that same reduced amount of funding this year as well. We had hoped that fees collected for this year would return to pre-pandemic levels, but they have not. We are extremely grateful for the appropriation we received last session, and we are working diligently to be good stewards of those dollars. Without your action, we would have faced unprecedented cuts in services. Instead, we can report that last year alone, we served 4,300 displaced homemakers, including their families. Those funds allowed us to continue providing services without interruption and despite deep cuts in our base funding source. A direct appropriation for the next year is critical to maintain services at current levels as we work to update our base funding. Thank you again for your time and consideration of House File 3321. Now I would like to turn things over to one of our past program participants, Stacey Gordon, to share her experience.
Thank you so much, Ms. Keenan, for your testimony. And Ms. Gordon, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. My name is Stacey Gordon. Previously, I had been in an unsafe relationship and knew for the safety of myself and my children that I had to leave. I moved to Brainerd not knowing anyone except for a few family members in the area. I didn't really have any support and I felt lost. I was now a single mother of four young children and was desperate to be able to provide for my family and create stability in our lives. I found out about the Minnesota Family Resiliency Partnership Program and enrolled. From the first moment that I met with the director, I was showered with love, hope, and support, something that had been lacking in my life. I was provided a supportive environment for me to pursue my education and career goals. Excuse my nerves. I attended and benefited from the various workshops and support groups. The different activities and things we learned and discussed, such as grief support, self-esteem, goal setting, resume writing, job interviewing skills, communication skills, all of which were very helpful. The computer lab was extremely beneficial to me as it was a quiet space that I could go to work on homework and do some job search, as I didn't have a computer at home, and having four kids at home made it very difficult for me to get anything done. Because I lacked confidence and support, I felt like I did not belong in college. This program helped me to assimilate into the world of academia at Central Lakes College. One of the biggest goals that this program helped me accomplish was getting my driver's license. I had a lot of fear and anxiety about driving, and this had always been a significant barrier for me and my family. My four children and I walked everywhere we went, rain or shine, and though we did what we had to do, walking in the cold and such was hard. I had little to no driving experience. The program director gave me the gentle nudge that I needed to finally take the step and take my road test. With the support and a newly found confidence in myself that I could actually do it, I passed my test. I am now a confident, independent driver, and we no longer have to walk, take a bus or cab, or bother anyone for a ride. It is a huge freedom. I had no idea how big of an impact it would make on my family. Another major goal accomplished with the help of this program was getting a car. The program was very instrumental in helping me apply for a grant for a donated car. I was so very happy to be the chosen recipient. I can also now happily say that I am a college graduate and I am gainfully employed in a career that I love where I can help and support others to reach their goals and also provide for my children and the three grandchildren who I'm also raising. I'm so grateful for the services that this program has provided and for all the support I was given. This program has helped me in so many ways and it has changed the course of my family forever. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Gordon, for your testimony and sharing your story and how this great program really supported you. And thank you so much for that and coming to the committee today. Members, any discussion?
Chairman.
Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to say, first of all, Ms. Gordon, you did a great job on your testimony. No need to be a little shy or nervous next time because you're fantastic. Secondly, I just want to offer up my support, Mr. Chairman. As you're putting your bill together, this is a great program, and I hope you strongly consider including this in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Lead Hamilton. Representative Baker.
Thank you again. I wanted to sort of echo what Representative Hamilton said here. I was able to carry this bill a couple years ago, and this is one of those bills that really, really hits the ground. The folks that are working on this really help people like Ms. Gordon. And again, I see this firsthand when we're helping people, recover from which may be folks suffering from SUD and things like that. But so many reasons why people are needing a hand to get moving along like this. So again, great job today. I'm super supportive of this bill. I'm proud to be a co-author. Thank you, Representative Breyer, for bringing it forward.
Thank you so much for your support, Representative Baker. As we did last session, we included the support for this program, and we'll continue to do our best to support it. Any further discussion, members? Representative Wright, do you have any closing remarks?
Just my thanks to the committee, especially to the testifiers, and especially Ms. Gordon. And I just want to tell you how much I appreciated the message on your whiteboard. It's really inspiring, and I'm sure the other people who talk to you get a lift from it as well. So thank you all.
Thank you so much, Representative Ryan, for bringing this bill forward. So I renew my motion, House File 3321, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. With that, members, I would like to turn this over to Commissioner Grove. Please welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and present the recommendations from the department.
Well, thank you, Chair Noor. Hello, committee. Good to see you all. Steve Grove here, Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And it's good to be together with you on this Monday. I'm excited to get the chance to share with you a bit more details about the governor's budget and his recommendations to this committee to move Minnesota's economy forward. And I'm going to be relatively brief here in my overview because we have some testifiers here today that I think will do a far better job of explaining why these components of the governor's budget are really essential to putting Minnesota on a forward-leaning orientation as we head into this next chapter of our economy. So I'm going to dive right in, eager to hear your questions as well. And again, Chair, thank you for the time. You know, I think the first item on our budget I want to walk through is one that is very temporally relevant. We all know, because we've been having this discussion in earnest, particularly the last few weeks, and that's focused on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. We had a chance to present on this topic in particular in more detail to this committee a month or two back. So I won't go into too much detail here, but I think you all know the math on this one. To prevent that tax hike on small businesses and businesses across our state, we need to put $2.73 billion into the trust fund very quickly. As of tomorrow, this gets a lot harder to unwind. And so time really is of the essence on this piece. And we encourage legislators to work together with us in the governor's office to move this forward. I will say in the same breath that, as you all know, the governor also has $1 billion devoted to frontline workers in his budget. And while that item is being carried by the Department of Labor with Commissioner Robertson, I was intimately involved last year in the Frontline Worker Committee, heard the testimony of so many leaders who are out there really on the front lines for all of us throughout the pandemic, keeping Minnesotans afloat and helping so many folks who were in pain and suffered through the pandemic make it through and their families as well. And so I just want to lift up that we think both of those items are incredibly important. The time sensitivity here on UI is well known at this point, but we think both are critical towards getting Minnesota on the right track. So this is our first budget item. Wanted to raise it again here. We'll stop with further details since I think we've had this discussion at length, but happy to answer any questions here as well as we go forward. The next section of things I want to bring up to all of us here are really about growing small businesses and attracting talent to our state. And here, I really can't overemphasize to you all how competitive the global economic landscape is right now. I think you all know this and see it as well. You know, we are facing unprecedented competition from other states, from other countries, for jobs, for talent, for where the next Fortune 500s are going to get built. And we are taking nothing for granted here in the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We are very focused on this area. And I think the first one that we're really focusing on is just how to make sure that we retain that uniqueness of our headquarters economy here in Minnesota. One of the reasons this economy is so unique is we're a great place to grow and build a business. So we're advocating for $5 million to enhance the Launch Minnesota program. This is a program you all know well and have helped build over the past few years. These dollars will go specifically towards helping new startups get going and helping startups scale up to more established companies when they're ready to do that. That's a tradition that Minnesota is uniquely positioned to serve given our talent market. And so these dollars go to an accelerator that would help really grow those Fortune 500s that are going to create the next wave of jobs for our state. It's a tremendously popular program. It's award-winning. And these additional dollars will address a really key need to compete with other major tech hubs that are drawing people in a really competitive time. So we're excited about this program in particular. Also excited about the state Small Business Credit Initiative. These are dollars that are coming to Minnesota from the federal government, almost $100 million coming. That's already guaranteed. But how we're able to use these to grow small businesses requires us to make a policy change through the legislature that will allow us to invest directly in those businesses. It's a small tweak, but it's needed tweak to make sure we can be on par with other states and use this money really effectively. Frankly, to get money to those who can't usually get it in traditional ways, whether it's through a bank or otherwise, this is for kind of non-traditional funding for businesses that we really want to see grow. And it's incredibly important to put Minnesota on the front edge of our economy. We also have money in the governor's budget to promote our state. And this is something, as I've talked to many of you individually and business leaders and everyone else that we engage with indeed on a regular basis, everyone kind of nods their heads and gets this. This is a really big deal. We are being outcompeted by our neighbors and by states across the country on the marketing scene. We don't have a marketing budget indeed. It's kind of one of those things when I came in, I kind of asked folks, where's the marketing budget? And they all kind of scratched their heads. We don't really have one, and we haven't. Minnesota as a state invests in our tourism marketing, which is really important. But our neighboring states are putting millions of dollars into campaigns to attract talent and jobs and business to their state. And we just aren't in that conversation. So we have built a brand new platform at joinsmn.com. It's a front door to our state, if you will, for businesses and for talent. We just need money to promote it. And this is money that really gets us in the game on this conversation at a very competitive time. We can't keep letting our neighbors eat our lunch and steal our workers. We have to be aggressive and promote what a great state this is for business and really direct businesses and people to come and grow here. So very important ask here as well. I will add as well, there's a component of this that involves staffing and growing the Minnesota Business Vitality Council. This is an interagency group that we've used to really partner with other agencies across state government to promote specific economic development issues, whether that be CTE in high schools, our hemp economy, childcare industry. This is an internal function we've created under Governor Walz to help really get agencies focused on economic development and growth. And it's been kind of staffed ad hoc up till now. And so establishing this as a full-time effort to really accelerate our work here in economic development is critical. So that's a key budget item as well. And then lastly, in this sort of bucket of things on expanding small business and growth, we're proposing a $50 million fund to run a grant and a lottery for nonprofits. We did some of these with small businesses over the last few years. Never did we focus on nonprofits who have bared so much of the weight of responding to the pandemic over the last few years and are such a huge part of Minnesota's economy, employing over 10% of Minnesotans. This is a grant program that would go a long way for them. Let's turn next to workforce. The name of this committee, the thing you're hearing about your constituents and business leaders and workers every single day, the number one economic development issue in our state is the labor shortage, and we need to focus on it in a multitude of ways. There are a lot of things across the governor's budget that focus on workforce, not just deeds, but I'll highlight here where deeds pieces fit into that broader picture. And just remind us at the outset, we're about 100,000 workers down since the start of the pandemic. We have about 205,000 open job vacancies. And if you look at the demography of our labor force, it has aged. We have 30 to 60,000 people who have retired early in Minnesota since the pandemic. So that's a trend line that's challenging. And we just face some major shortages in some key industries. So the first area that we're really focused on is where we see the jobs going, and that's in technology. We know the fastest growing jobs in Minnesota are in technology, and they pay some of the best wages in the state. And you can see some of the data here. There's just no question that this is the future of Minnesota's economy, and not just in tech companies per se, right? But tech jobs in every company that exists across Minnesota. We need to make sure we have the workers that can take those new jobs and have much longer term potential than so many other professions. Tech jobs are growing about twice as fast as other occupations. We'll have about 35,000 openings in this industry over the next decade. Challenges, our pipeline isn't good here. And so we start at the beginning of that pipeline with youth. We know that if we don't start early getting young people engaged in computer science, engaged in job training, we won't have the pipeline that we need 5-10 years down the line. We are proposing $15 million for a grant program to focus on this. And just to put it in perspective, how challenged Minnesota's pipeline is, we are 50th out of 50 states when it comes to computer science AP examinations in high schools. We just don't graduate students with those skill sets. This is a huge challenge where we're a state that's used to being first or second in things, and we're last place in the country on youth tech workforce. We have got to change that. And frankly, we have to change it, most importantly, for workers of color and youth of color who just don't have the same exposure or access to leaders in this field. So this grant program could transform how we do this work at the agency. There's no tool that we have at our disposal to focus on this challenge. So we're really eager here to grow this space. And then similarly, we want to make sure that anybody who wants to reskill and shift from industries into tech can do so as well. So if you're an adult, and the pandemic may have made you rethink your career path or where you want to go, you should be able to reskill, pick up some new skills and expand and grow. And this is a grant program that would help you do just that. It's hard to change jobs. Switching costs can be high. Some training can make a big difference. And specifically, again, on tech, where all the jobs are growing the fastest. So we're really eager on these two programs for our tech workforce. And then we also have a program focused on clean tech. We all know that the green revolution is very much here, and jobs in clean tech are growing extremely fast. We want to partner with Commerce on a very specific program on workforce for clean tech, solar panel construction, building weatherization, really critical. Again, we're trying to go where the jobs are going to be, not go where the jobs were. And so these three workforce programs really get us in that kind of trying to predict the future with all the data we have and make sure we're building workforce programs for it. Speaking of the future, I'll tell you what is not futuristic about our current system. And that is our current workforce development digital platform. We are woefully out of date when it comes to our technology infrastructure for helping workers find jobs. And This is not something that we, again, have a budget for in government. We have a very kind of in-person brick and mortar system. In-person is great, brick and mortar is fine, but people today find jobs on these things. This is the way that they interact with the economy. And if we're gonna have a workforce development system that actually works in the 21st century, we need the tools to get there. So we have a $15 million budget item focused on modernizing our digital infrastructure. And on the next slide, you'll see an example of why that's so important. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the front door of Minnesota's workforce development labor exchange. We are required by the federal government to have this website. And I guess I would ask if anybody landed on this website and looked at it, would they think, oh boy, I'm about to find an amazing job. Look at how dynamic and confidence building this website is. Of course, it's not. It looks like it was made about 20 years ago. It was, and it was revolutionary at the time, but we have not updated it, nor do we have the money to do so. So this is a really important advancement that, again, with one-time dollars at this historic moment, we could really change how we do this work in Minnesota. Last workforce program I'll mention to everybody here is one I know this committee has thought about a lot and several of you have advocated for vociferously, and that is paid family medical leave. We very intentionally call this a workforce program because we think it will help our workforce grow. We think it's a real differentiator for our state. If we offer this paid family medical leave benefit that is truly just modern table stakes for an economy. This is most important for small businesses. All the big businesses offer this just as a starting point. How could you not have paid family medical leave, Target or Best Buy would ask. But for smaller business, of course, it's challenging because the costs don't work out. So for really the price of a cup of coffee per worker per week, I'll say that again, the price of a cup of coffee per worker per week, you can have a system that ensures those benefits are afforded every Minnesotan, and talk about a differentiator. We're trying to attract people to the state, differentiate Minnesota. This program would do just that. And we have a great model with UI to base it off of in terms of our experience in the state. We just need to get going. So the money here would be to build the technology platform to start collecting those payroll taxes to build that system for Minnesotans. And, you know, it's kind of a double whammy for workforce too, because if you can take time off to be with your young one in those early days when they're born, with like my wife and I were lucky to be able to do, it is the most important brain development window for our future workers 10, 20 years down the line to have that connection with parents, and particularly right when they're born. And we just don't offer that for our workers in the state. And so I think doing so is just really critical to grow our economy. So those are some of the workforce ideas. Again, lots in other committees and other agencies. So this isn't the full picture, and we can provide a full picture of the entirety of workforce just for that kind of understanding. But these are the deep pieces that we're asking you all to consider here in this committee. And then I'll focus next talking about new workers. And we're joined here in the committee today by my colleague, Anissa Haji-Mumin, who's our assistant commissioner for our New Americans office. This is an office we started about a year ago, a little year and change ago, to really focus in on helping make sure our newest Americans in Minnesota get great jobs and contribute to the economy. And not every business has that pathway into these communities to hire these workers, but Anissa is really changing that. She's been funded, and her office has been funded by a grant that's running out. So it's an external grant, it's a third party grant. We are asking to get a modest sum of money to make this work ongoing. And so you see that those dollars here. This is the future of Minnesota's economy. Any population growth we've had in the last two decades has come because we've welcomed new Americans into our state. This is the American story. It's the Minnesota story. We need to make sure that we're doing our part for them to make sure we get them great jobs and the businesses can access these workers to grow our economy. We also have an item in our budget to establish an ombudsman with Indeed to focus on agriculture workers in particular, making sure that they are safe and well. This is coming off of an executive order the governor did about a year ago, and it's an important committee to make sure that we are ensuring that our migrant workers, 70% of which are from outside the country, are well taken care of here in our state and contribute to the economy and do so safely and in a way that that honors them as workers and helps our businesses grow. And then we're also, just in addition to funding the office that would do that work, want to extend the committee as well to make sure that this really important group of agencies coming together around this issue can continue to collaborate on this topic. And then our last area of focus before we turn to testifiers and any questions that the committee might have is on addressing climate change to create new economic opportunity. And I think, pick your headline. Everyone here knows why climate change is such an existential threat to our environment, but frankly, it is to our economy as well. It also opens up huge lanes of economic opportunity for us as a state to grow. I mentioned the clean tech workforce program a moment ago. Two other things to flag for you here in the governor's budget focus on climate change. One is on electric vehicles. This is the future. There's just no question about it. We'll all be driving EVs soon enough, but we want to accelerate it to make sure that Minnesota is in the leading edge of this. And it's harder for businesses to make that transformation of an entire fleet, given the upfront costs, not only for the vehicles, but also the charging stations. So this is a grant program we would use to help businesses make that transition more quickly. I think anytime you're trying to make that kind of economic transition, there's not going to always be the incentives in the market to do it without a little bit of help from government. So this is the role we think government can play to really move this along in Minnesota and put us on a leading edge that's going to create more jobs and opportunity here in our state compared to others. And then lastly, you know, we know that many communities across Minnesota have very real deadlines in front of them for when coal plants are shutting down. This is a transition that we're going through as a state for the next 10 to 20 years. Some of them happening much sooner, frankly, where coal plants are shutting down and what's next is being built. We really want to make sure that those communities that are going through those transitions can help build what's next with state support. And so we have an energy transition office that we've just started at DEED, funded through last budget, that will help with some of the planning there to bring new jobs to replace those that we're losing to these shutter plants. But we don't have any grants that go directly to the community to help them with that process. So these dollars, $2.5 million, our grant program would help specifically those 8 to 10 counties and cities that are facing those closures really build the next chapter of what their local economy is going to be about. So really important component of our budget here. That's the last item I was going to raise for everyone here. Again, I just want to thank everyone on the committee for your thoughtful work. It's been great to see the issues that you've been raising and the debates you've been having and the programs that you're bringing forward. We're looking forward to a great session. This really is, I think, as we all know, just a historic opportunity with this surplus at this inflection point in our economy to make the right investments to move Minnesota forward into this next generation. And I think, honestly, the decisions that we make over the next 2 or 3 months are going to have impact for the next 2 or 3 decades in Minnesota. So, Mr. Chair, I know I have some testifiers. I'll stop there, turn it over to you, and just thank you again for the chance to connect today.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. I know there are many questions that we may have, but I wanted to go straight to the testifiers. Good, Ramji, are you up? Ramji, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ramji Ayer. I'm the founder and chief executive officer of LaPlace Interventional. I'm here to discuss the importance of Launch Minnesota and the need for proposed the Business Acceleration Grant Program. So before I go any further, let me explain what LaPlace Interventional is doing. So we are developing a transcatheter heart valve that is deployed using a minimally invasive procedure for patients suffering from tricuspid regurgitation. And there are more than 500,000 new patients just in the US and Europe that are diagnosed with that. So it's a large medical problem and an unmet clinical need that we're trying to solve. So, and despite such a high mortality rate, which is more than 50% at 4 years, a lot of these patients, more than 90% of them, go untreated, and there is really no good treatment for the ones currently. So our company's aim is to offer these patients an increase in quality of life and their life expectancy. So in terms of how Launch MN has helped LaPlace, first of all, I mean, LaPlace received a grant of innovation grant of $31,500 at the end of 2020. And we have since then come significantly forward in terms of building the company and building the product as well. So I'm proud to share that just within 1 year after receiving our grant, LaPlace closed on a Series A investment of $7.9 million. Which we have been focusing on towards our preclinical research milestones. Since then, we have also expanded our internal team. At that point, when we received the Launch MN grant, it was basically just me trying to build a business and trying to build a product. But since then, we have actually increased our internal team from 1 to 6. We've also moved into a facility in Plymouth where we have set up our R&D lab, which has been significantly used for design iterations, prototype builds, and testing, essentially at a high level, we're progressing our research and development efforts. We've also been issued some patents and continue to file additional. So, in a nutshell, I don't think we could have even started and made all these progress without the Launch MN grant. It played such a critical role in Laplace's initiation and journey so far. So very thankful for that. Now, just moving on to the business acceleration program. So yes, we have made good progress, and yes, we have done have been going well, and we are marching ahead.
Mr. Ayer, I think we lost your audio.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. You can still hear me, correct?
Yes. Please proceed.
Yep. Okay. So So we are really on to our next phase of working towards first accomplishing the preclinical milestones, then accomplishing some clinical feasibility, and then moving on to a larger clinical trial, and then basically commercializing. So I'm in it for the next 5 to 7 years before we can really commercialize and essentially take it and be impactful all over the world. To accomplish this, I think Laplace needs to continuously grow its team, seek further technical and regulatory assistance, and essentially a connected and a collaborative network of people and organizations will be vital to the success of the business in the next stage of growth. So, like I've mentioned before, Launch Minnesota has been significantly helpful, and it will be. And I think a business acceleration program that has been proposed would be significantly beneficial for Laplace, and also other startups from Minnesota. So, that's what I wanted to share with all of you all, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ayer, and thank you for your information on the Launch Minnesota Grid program to support the expansion of the technology ecosystem in the state. So grateful for what you're doing, and looking forward to see what you can achieve next. So members, to the testifiers, please keep it to 2 to 3 minutes so we can go to the members' discussion. The next person is Suzanne Fuller-Max. Welcome to the committee, and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor, and member of the Workforce Business Development and Finance and Policy Committee. I'm testifying today to support Commissioner Steve Grove and his request to you today. My name is Suzanne Fuller-Burks, and I'm the Executive Director of Phyllis Wheatley Community Center in North Minneapolis. Phyllis Wheatley was founded in 1924 as a settlement house and is one of the oldest African-American nonprofit organizations in Minnesota. Phyllis Wheatley was the only place for African-Americans to stay when traveling to Minnesota because they weren't welcome at hotels. It was also a place where they learned job skills, particularly secretarial skills, and celebrate culture and community without fear or concern for their safety. Today, we are on a mission to create pathways for individuals to discover their strengths and take control of their futures. To achieve the mission, we envision a vibrant, intergenerational community where everyone has opportunity and access to essential resources. When I returned to Minnesota to lead Phyllis Wheatley in June of 2020, the board agreed that one of the key areas of focus would be digital literacy. It was clear there was a critical gap in the business community as well as in adult tech skills training in the community at large. When I say community, it is acknowledged that the community in which we are located in is much more diverse than it ever has been, particularly in near North Minneapolis. It is no longer primarily African-American, but it is comprised of over 88% BIPOC individuals and families. According to Minnesota Department of Health 2017 research report on people in poverty in Minnesota, it states that over 62% of this particular population has a high school diploma or less, 75% live below 200% of the poverty level, and 24% are unemployed. Now, this is pre-COVID. Most of Phyllis Wheatley's families are below the poverty guidelines, as I just So we work hard to provide additional support to them, including access to livable skills jobs, affordable quality childcare, and other need resources. It is our belief that the key to an inclusive economic recovery will be to provide digital skills to people that are hardest hit, especially by job losses, or those with low incomes, men and BIPOC individuals. In today's economy, especially with multi-billion dollar industries, young adults will need to develop new digital skills to secure a new job or basically just to get back to work. As referenced by the Brookings Institute's December 8, 2020 publication, The Black and White Wealth Gap, left households more vulnerable, found that the unemployment rate even worse in many majority BIPOC communities, sometimes times more than whites, therefore presenting a greater need to implement digital skills training and job placement. I will tell you that Phyllis Wheatley was proud to be one of the four organizations to be selected statewide to participate in DC Tech training pilot program, targeting young adults 18 to 30, again, BIPOC individuals in the tech career pathways. We have now more than 55% qualified referrals in our first cohort, and we believe we will more than exceed our targeted goal for the year. We have corporate partners such as Medtronic, 3M, Comcast, Microsoft, and more who have agreed to hire these individuals if they complete the program. The last comment I wanted to make, and I meant to share this with Commissioner Grove and others, is that it's my hope Minnesota considers being a robust tech industry with marketing support, as Commissioner Grove asked for, like Georgia in the entertainment industry. Here's just a few stats and then I'll close. According to the Georgia Film Office, 51% of Georgians were employed in the film industry. About 390 film and productions were created in the industry in fiscal 2019. They spent $209 billion for production crews and $9.2 billion in total wages in 2019. Another 20,000 work in the state's music industry, which brings in an average income of $3.7 billion to the state. And I leave you with those thoughts, and it's my hope that the state of Minnesota will continue to support the DEED's request under the Commissioner Grove and consider focusing on a tech industry here in Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Noor, and the members of this committee.
Thank you, Ms. Bax, for your testimony. The next person is Mr. Hared. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Mahmoud and other committees. My name is Abdullah Hared Sharif, from Somali Community Resettlement Services. And I'd like to testify the programs that we work with the DEED, especially for the Commissioner Steve. The programs that I'm actually testifying about, the adult support services, and we have other programs for the youth programs that we work with the these programs in Greater Minnesota, especially for Rochester, Owatonna, and Faribault, and also Minneapolis. The two programs that we have, one of the youth program at work and the adult service program. The adult service program is the people that we work with, the adults who have not been experiencing or very newly arrived and low English speakers and no experience at all. And these people, actually, what we do, we help them about getting to understand the language. We have ESL classes. We're working with the ABE, adult basic educations, in order to get and learn about the basic terminology language that they can start for employments. There are so many barriers that they have. These people have low language, you know, culturals, and some of them are very have difficulty getting about the childcare and all those things. So what we do, we usually help them about getting all those stuff to make it ready. We also working on partner with the employers, such as the DICON, which is actually located for the Faribault, Faricon, who actually located in Owatonna, and some of the IBM actually, even though they don't usually take a lot of people, but there are people who are taken to the for the little bit high tech. Those actually, so far we have been about so many people for the youth, also the youth that we work with, there are so many youth that we have and issues. Those who are still in school and some of them are not graduated and maybe they did not actually graduated for on time, they so they are taken to the the GED programs. So we help them, those people, to get a actually start for a job in order to come, you know, the self-sufficient. So we've been working with the 50 people for the youth for last year and this year also. So when it comes to this program, it actually helping about this immigrant to become a more active and more involved about the employment. The programs that also we help them about include the Latinos. We find about the area that we are specialists for the greater Minnesota. We have seen so many Latinos who don't have any other getting any supports. So we've been helping about getting this in order to actually be part of the community, but members. So we are avoiding to not work with the only with the Somalis, but also some other East African, Latinos. We get very few limited about other communities like Hmong, but we haven't mentioned a lot on that programs. So what I see actually, this program helps about to increase the number of the employments, especially for the adults and the youth. So we encourage actually for the legislators, youth, Mahmoud Noor and others to support with these programs. And it is a game change about it for this program. I want to limit it about the, and I give you more time that you guys have the questions. So thank you, Mahmoud Noor and other, members of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Harred, for your testimony. The next person is Mr. Hansen. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed. You're muted. You're on mute. Go ahead now.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Good afternoon, Chair Noor and members. My name is Brian Hansen. I'm the President and CEO of APEX, the Area Partnership for Economic Expansion. We're based in Duluth with a satellite office in Grand Rapids. APEX provides economic development services in the 7-county Arrowhead region in Northeast Minnesota and 3 counties in Northwest Wisconsin. APEX investor members represent some of the most influential companies in our region with a collaborative approach to promoting sustainable economic growth. Our mission is to leverage private sector resources to drive investment in the APEX region. I'm here today to testify about the importance of marketing the great state of Minnesota. I can't tell you how many times I've been told by business professionals, site selection consultants in particular, that Minnesota is the best kept secret in this country. For too long, we've been left in the shadows of neighboring states who have the resources to successfully tell their story. Right now, in particular, after the economic and social unrest we've all experienced together, we have to tell our own positive story, not the negative narrative that we all saw spread by mainstream media. The Minnesota Marketing Partnership is one of the groups working hand in hand with DEED to change that narrative and drive investment in Minnesota. The partnership's 70-plus members come together from all corners of the state to encourage a national and international audience of business leaders and employees to join us in Minnesota. Partnership members include regional groups like APEX, local economic developers representing counties and cities, our utilities, and other private businesses. All of these members together make a significant investment in the partnership. In addition, those of us on the front lines of events such as trade shows, conferences, recruiting visits, and familiarization tours contribute even more of our funds from our organizations to help make those events a success. The partnership enables the state to be present at events. What I call this sort of bake sale approach of funding partnership events is unheard of in other states. We need resources to support a collective marketing effort to put Minnesota on the map and tell our own positive story for all the right reasons. In 2020 and 2021, the marketing partnership had limited ability to travel telling our story. So we spent our partnership resources, unfortunately, including holding another bake sale to create the Join Us Minnesota campaign. Now, DEED has embraced that campaign and expanded on it, as Commissioner Grove mentioned. But a consequence of limited resources is limited reach. We need to get the message out on a nationwide and worldwide basis. The governor's supplemental budget includes about $4.2 million for marketing the state. Each year, partnership members work very closely with our deed partners to assemble our strategy for what I'll call that boots on the ground efforts to market the business opportunities available in the state of Minnesota. That includes our collateral materials, training, trade and conference events, attendance, hosted in-state events, and site visits in targeted locations. I'll note that these activities include both business recruitment and much-needed workforce attraction events to support the needs of our existing employers. We think that a portion of these funds, the $4.2 million, could help us level the playing field with competing states and nations. At Apex, over 10% of our budget, or $80,000 a year, is dedicated to marketing for business and workforce development. That includes the successful North Forest Retention and Recruitment Program that was co-established by Apex and our partners at the Norseman Group. A little bit before the state's career force was unveiled, we think they kind of liked our name. Anyway, about half of that $80K or $40K is dedicated to activities we carry out with the partnership, just from this organization, Apex. Many other Minnesota marketing partners are definitely doing their part as well. The requested marketing appropriation would benefit the Apex region by leveraging our resources with state funds and helping us attract both businesses and much needed workforce. So that's why I'm here today, to lend support for an appropriation specifically for this purpose. Let's give it a try. Let's track our results and see if we can get Minnesota back on the map of best places to grow a business. Thank you, members. I'm happy to hear any questions later.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hansen, for your testimony. The next person is Mr. Palmer. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman Noor. Good afternoon. My name is Jonathan Palmer. I am the Executive Director of Hallie P. Brown Community Center. Chairman Noor and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm doing so about the importance of the Nonprofit Resiliency and Recovery Fund mentioned here in the budget proposal, as well as the coalition bill that our group of nonprofits have put together. It is one of the things that is very important to the continued recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic of nonprofit organizations. Like our sister organization, Phyllis Wheatley, Hallie Key Brown is a 93-year-old African-American social service agency that is open to everyone and comes out of the Settlement House movement. Like a few nonprofits that were essential service agencies, when the pandemic started, we were asked to stay open, but there were not a lot of resources initially. We saw at Hallie a 4,000% increase in new clients visiting our food shelf, going from 108 new clients signing up in March of 2020 to 1,808 new clients signing up in June of 2020. But we also lost about 90% of our volunteers because of them being vulnerable. And so we had to go ahead and pivot and use additional staffing in any way that we could. A lot of times our leadership team was doing a lot of the packing of the boxes and delivery out to the community. A generous community stepped in to help fill the financial gaps, as well as the foundational community and others. But the giving has cooled off, and philanthropy simply isn't enough to stabilize us during this recovery period. Many Minnesotans are bouncing back during this recovery period, but many in our community who were already struggling before the pandemic will be dealing with compounding damage done through the crisis for years to come. The food, the emergency support, and childcare that organizations like ours have been a lifeline for an increasing number of Minnesotans. Funding shortfalls and a diminished workforce paired with an increased demand for services and supply chain challenges are making it difficult for nonprofits to continue operating at the levels that the community need to recover and rebuild from COVID-19 is. Nonprofits like mine need flexible operating capital right now. We need the ability to quickly invest in our people and in our operations so that we can stabilize our organizations and continue to help people in the community from all across the state. Our organization pre-pandemic was serving primarily St. Paul. During the pandemic, we were serving people from all across the state. To date, nonprofits have been largely left out of state and federal relief programs, While many industries and sectors had access to one or more programs of dollars specific to meet their needs, the nonprofit sector has had no designated relief dollars for recovery, and we are frontline essential agencies. I've also been asked to share that the coalition's bill also has had a responsive to the needs of our community approach and the needs of smaller and culturally specific organizations that come with that. The $200 million ask in our bill is based on data of the number of organizations with the greatest need, and our bill includes specifics on how that will be implemented using input data from nonprofits across the state. We see this as in conjunction and working together with the needs and with what has been put forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Mr. Palmer, for your testimony. The next person on the list is Mr. O'Neill. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff O'Neill. I'm currently serving as interim administrator for the city of Becker, Minnesota. Previously served 14 years as the city administrator for Monticello. This experience provides me with firsthand understanding of the challenges whole cities are facing in making the transition to the new energy economy. Thank you for the opportunity to share my knowledge with you in support of the aid budget request. I can assure you that host communities have proudly supported the operation of nuclear and coal electric generation facilities for the benefit of the citizens of the state and are now striving to evolve with the changing times, but it's not going to be easy. Host communities appreciate the governor and legislature's acknowledgement of the significant challenges facing communities most affected by this new energy economy and the associated transition. I'm here today to testify in support of additional funding for the Energy Transition Grant Program, which was first created in 2020, to provide planning and economic development grants to communities in Minnesota who are facing the impending retirement of investor-owned power plants in their communities. First, again, thank you, Deed, for the governor's and the governor for including $2.5 million for these grants in the agency's supplemental budget request. Becker and Monticello, crisscrossed by power lines, are just a few miles apart, and both host to two of Xcel Energy's largest power plants, the Sherco Coal Plant in Becker and the Monticello Nuclear Plant located in Monticello. For these two communities and other plant host communities across the state, property taxes attributed to the plants can make up to 40 to 75% of the city's tax base and also contribute significantly to local schools and counties. Moreover, plant operations and employees are deeply intertwined with the character and economic well-being of the communities in numerous other ways. Beginning next year, with the retirement of Sherco 1, or one of the three coal-fired units at Sherco plant, all of Minnesota's largest power plants are either scheduled for retirement or will be considered for retirement within the next 20 years. City leaders in each of the plant communities are doing everything within their power to plan for transition and develop a future for their communities. But the scale and complexity of this transition is more than these communities have the capacity to tackle on their own. These energy transition grants are a key tool that the state can use to help local leaders in this transition. Investments in planning are necessary for making strategic decisions necessary to successfully shift reliance from a single major taxpayer to a more diverse economic base. Fortunately, host communities in Minnesota all possess a set of important economic development attributes that can be leveraged to create attractive shovel-ready sites for driving economic growth. But this will only happen with solid land use, infrastructure, and transportation planning. For instance, both Becker and Monticello, with the decommissioning of power plants, large land areas well-suited for industrial development will become available. Additionally, these areas are located in close proximity to city utility systems, close to rail, and major transportation corridors. However, close is not good enough, and significant infrastructure and financial planning is needed for developing strategies for providing these municipal services to the development sites themselves. For example, Monticello, the nuclear power plant, and a large area of nearby undeveloped land adjacent to I-94 are well suited for industrial development. However, the freeway, so close yet so far, sits some distance away from freeway access and also a good distance from utility systems. Physical and financial plans need to be prepared today and a strategy set for eventual extension of utilities and development of an interchange for this area to blossom. Similarly, in Becker, ongoing development of rail access, extension of utilities, as well as identifying the need to construct a rail overpass have begun to position Becker for the future. However, these efforts are just a start with more detailed planning and strategies needed that will lead to construction of utility and road systems to provide that framework necessary to actually support future development. Our colleagues in Oak Park Heights will need ongoing support in navigating the closure of Xcel's LNS King plant, which sits right at the St. Croix River and presents a number of very complex questions for the community's future. So our communities are racing the clock. The state has recognized its essential role in this transition through this grant program, the creation of an energy transition office and advisory committee at DEED, and will hopefully soon undertake additional efforts. More funding of these grants are an essential tool to keep this work moving forward. I will note also, please, that the Coalition of Utility Cities also supports some tweaks to the program to help function more effectively and to discuss those changes with the agency. These provisions are contained in Representative Christensen's House File 3985, and we hope the committee will take a look at those as well. So in closing, I thank the committee again for the opportunity to speak in support of community energy transition grants and urge you to continue this discussion and include funding for the program in the budget bill this session. I stand for questions later.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. O'Neill, for your testimony. The last but not the least is Mr. Andre. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and members of the committee. My name is Rich Andre. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for State and Local Initiatives at the American Immigration Council. The council works to create a more welcoming America, one that provides a fair immigration process for new Americans and adopts policies that take into account the vital contributions that this community makes across the U.S. economy. I am testifying today in strong support of the creation of an Office of New Americans in Minnesota. Over the past several years, my organization has worked with leaders in government, business, and civil society to establish and support similar state-level offices across the country. To facilitate the social, economic, and cultural integration of immigrants and refugee communities, these offices work across state agencies and community-based organizations to ensure equitable access to services and information, engage the private sector to attract and retain international talent and secure employment, and convene relevant stakeholders to best coordinate efforts. Minnesota has the opportunity to join a growing number of states that recognize the return on investing in new American integration. Last year alone, Colorado, Maryland, and Oregon all enacted bipartisan legislation to establish such statewide offices, bringing the total number of states with dedicated offices or senior advisor positions to 15. Several of these offices are focused on ensuring the full participation of new Americans into the workforce. For example, the Office of Global Michigan worked with the state's Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs to create 44 licensing guides over 3 years to help internationally trained professionals attain licenses and certifications for in-demand jobs, including for doctors, teachers, cosmetologists, and more. My organization, in collaboration with World Education Services Global Talent Bridge, convenes these offices through the Office of New Americans State Network. Anissa Hajimumin, Assistant Commissioner of Immigrant and Refugee Affairs at DEED, is an active participant in the network, where she has learned best practices from her counterparts across the country. With Anissa's expertise, Minnesota is well positioned to create an Office of New Americans to facilitate the full integration of the state's vibrant immigrant and refugee communities to the benefit of all Minnesotans. To help illustrate why this issue is so important and why it makes sense to think of the Office of New Americans as an economic integration and workforce issue, my organization has conducted quantitative research on the impact of immigrants and refugees that they're already having across the state of Minnesota as of 2019. And what we found was quite striking. Minnesota is home to nearly 500,000 immigrants and refugees, making up 8.5% of the state's population, which means that about 1 in 12 Minnesotans is foreign born. This community is critical to the state's future workforce. 82% of new Minnesotans are of working age, defined as ages 16 to 64, compared to 61% of their U.S.-born counterparts. New Minnesotans are feeling critical shortages in high-needs industries like healthcare and food processing. Although they make up 8.5% of the state's population, immigrants and refugees represent one quarter of physicians, one third of nursing assistants, and more than 40% of workers in the animal processing industry. New Minnesotans also contribute to the tax base. As of 2019, they paid $4.8 billion in taxes, including $1.7 billion in state and local taxes. And they held $12.6 billion in spending power that is reinjected right back into the state's economy. Minnesota has the opportunity to maximize this economic impact, invest in the state's future workforce, and ensure the full integration of immigrants and refugees. I encourage the committee to support the creation of the Minnesota Office of New Americans. Thank you for your time. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you so much, Mr. Andre, for your testimony. And yes, immigrants and refugees are also legislators. We have a couple of them right here, and also assistant commissioners. So thank you so much for your testimony. I have a couple of questions, but I'll give you to start, Representative Baker.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It was really helpful to hear so many of the folks here today kind of supporting the programs that the governor's got planned. And again, hearing from Mr. Nelson with the Apex Group and others and transforming the energy grid and everything else to our new systems coming up, this is good stuff that we have to work with. But here's the thing that I guess I'm having a hard time with right now, Mr. Chair, and I need to employ and implore our DFL members to really listen to what Commissioner Grove is saying about this unemployment issue. Tomorrow is the day that we have got to get this thing together, because all the ideas that we heard today, folks, I don't think we want to give Commissioner Grove the weight of a $2.7 billion tax increase on businesses if we don't get this thing done. And I know that we want to circle back on this, but all these cool ideas that we're talking about here, when Representative Olson comes to us last year to try to get support for the Lake Superior paper mill and all those things that needed help, we were there for them. We promised businesses during the pandemic that we would not hold you, we will hold you harmless when it came to unemployed people all across the state so quickly. Every one of us in this committee stood up and said, good job, Commissioner Grove and your department for deploying so much money so fast when we needed this from you. So, and over the weekend, Commissioner Grove has been tweeting to say, this is really important. This is a complicated system. If we don't change this now and you want to just go for another couple more weeks, it takes months to unravel this. So I'm trying to understand why my friends on the DFL, and maybe this is a Chair Knorr question, but I want to understand, is your leadership hearing you, Chair Knorr? Because I heard this last Thursday, the majority leader said this is a tax cut for businesses if this somehow goes into effect. We're trying to eliminate that. Nobody's been affected yet as of today. There has not been a tax increase yet on this. But to delay this decision and this movement, I just want to let you know that there is no options of delaying here, or it causes us great strife in the businesses that were there for our employees to keep them safe, that when we had to unemploy because we got shut down because the government told us to shut down, we had no choice, but yet we were there for them. And we promised businesses we would not hold you accountable for that loss. And so to Chair, and again, we've got the Deputy Majority Leader on the call here. We've got others. I must implore the DFL members, you have got to understand this is what we promised them, and your bill is very similar to the Senate to some degree if we could talk about some of the other industries you want to include there, Chair Knorr, but this is really important. And again, I can say this because I'm a rabble rouser sometimes in my own party, and I need to have folks that are not afraid to stand up in your own party to say, this is the right thing to do. We had three members of the DFL on Thursday vote to take up that matter of urgency of taking on this unemployment issue. And congrats to those three members. But to Chair Knorr, this is the workforce committee. We have got to do the right thing. Commissioner Grove and Governor Walz are trying to do the right thing right now for this. And I just, I guess I just want to ask the question to the chair. When you send that message up the pipe, are they not hearing you? Do they not believe Commissioner Grove is saying this is really important? So to Chair Knorr, why aren't they hearing us? This is the Job Force Committee. Why aren't they hearing us?
Thank you so much, Representative Beck. I think you posed the question to two individuals here, Liz Olson, Representative Olson, and myself. Let's put the record straight. I did not see any bill or anything that promised to change the system the way it was designed to work. None. To the contrary, the date of 15th does not exist in any law whatsoever. That's the reality that we live in. So when the system, the way it was designed, the UI Trust Fund is self-correcting, meaning that during economic crisis, the UI Trust Fund is depleted. And then when we have a good economy going, the trust fund will accumulate more resources so we can pay the UI benefits. So the notion of March 15th does not exist. Let me put it that way. What exists is the determination letter that the employers received on or before December 15th of last year. The tax rate for every employer, including the tax rate increases, additional assessment, the fees, and everything for this year was included in that letter. That means every employer in the state of Minnesota is aware of how much they'll be paying the amount. And to ask the question, how much did we really receive as deposit into the state? What I'm looking here at the memo number 3348103, that was way after March 15th. In fact, the data that I have shows that the payments come in at the end of the month. This is now us intervening with what is already in the system. And I'll put it this way. If there's any increase, it's not 500%. And I can share with you right now to show that the increases are $1 a day, if there's any. And quite frankly, we have a system. And if the laws are not working, we need to correct that. A way to refund the employers, a way to give them a credit. It's all designed. The taxable wage was set up by June 30th. The other changes, the experience rating was set up by December 15th. The base rate was set up by March 31st of last year. The additional assessment was set up at March 31st of last year. All those are already in the law. What is not in the law is for us to upfront that $2.7 billion. Nothing whatsoever. So for us, we are willing to support businesses as long as we are working together to address that need. And I'll call Representative Olson because she was called upon.
I guess, Mr. Chair, sorry, I wasn't sure that I had asked her a question. I used her as an example because she was in front of our committee before. Certainly, if she wants to answer the question, she certainly can. But my point was this, is that nobody has had an increase yet. Yes, we were notified in December that this is a change. And then January 1st is the official date that those new rates take in effect. But we promised our businesses, Chair Knorr, that we weren't going to do this to them. We had the time to do this. You know that we can do this. You don't have to have a bill written to make this correction because we told them we were going to do this. So my point is March 15th is a date that the deed office, who are the smartest people we have in our system that knows exactly when is the right time to do this, they said March 15th. And I don't know why for any reason you think that that's phony, why they're lying to us. They're not. It's what they told us. And so we've been working to this date, and this is what we want to do.
Representative Beck, I think nobody stated the department or anybody is lying to us.
No, but you're poo-pooing that date like it's no big deal.
But quite frankly, where is the law that we have to upfront $2.7 billion? That's the question that I have. Nothing.
The law is, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, the law was, not the law, the promise was, we said we were going to hold businesses harmless for that. And so this is our chance to do that. So just I know you've got a lot of folks in questions, and I'm going to wrap up, Mr. Chair, because this is important to hear from others. But I'm just saying this is the moment we have right now within 24 hours. Our deed office has said this is what we have to do. Let's do the right thing here, members. And I hope that other DFL members hear this because their businesses are counting on us so that we can promote and market Minnesota as a great place to do business. But there's a huge looming tax increase coming in about 24 hours. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I'll disagree with that. There's no looming. It's the system the way it was designed to work. And none of us made the promise. We actually took care of businesses with holding back the experience rating, which will have quadrupled, tripled. At the same time, we held back the taxable wage income for last session. So that's something that we did and we promised and we took care of that. None of the employers are going to be impacted by the experience rating due to the COVID pandemic payments. That is in the law that we passed. With that, I just wanted to give Representative Olson because her name was called.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I can respond at the time of just my comment, I think, which will be wrapped up into that. And you could let Representative Juergens go and I can just capture everything all at once if you prefer.
Very well. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the testimony today and especially the comments that Commissioner Grove gave earlier and recognize the fact that both the UI Trust Fund and the frontline worker pay issues are both important. But the difference, as he pointed out, is that one of them has a deadline, and that deadline is tomorrow. And I know that, Chair Knorr, from your comments, you don't see that as a deadline. But I just go back to what I read on social media yesterday. Unemployment taxes are complex. We must, and we want to make sure everyone has an accurate, timely bill. Delaying past March 15th creates confusion for businesses, and it might take months to recalculate bills and provide refunds to businesses who overpay. That was Commissioner Grove yesterday. And I trust Commissioner Grove to understand the situation. All due respect, Chair Nord, this is what he does. And he's not taking the orders or taking direction from DFL House leadership. We heard on Thursday, Leader Winkler linked the two issues. In fact, he linked the unemployment trust fund to the entire DFL agenda for this year. So I went back to my district on Friday and told people, don't count on this getting done before the third week of May, because there's no urgency on the part of the DFL leadership. They're linking their entire agenda to this one issue. And who suffers for this? Every business in the state, every employer in the state. These funds are there to help employees when they get laid off. And now the funds aren't going to be there. And there's no reason to move past this deadline. It's time to let's get this done. Let's do the right thing for the employees and the employers. And don't play political football like we did with the income taxes on the PPP last year that took us not even to the end of session, but to the end of the special session at the end of June. You know, people are tired of this politics. Let's just do the right thing and let's get this done for everyone. And let's do it right.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Juergens. I think I still want to know which law are we saying that we have to pass in order to do this? None whatsoever. There's no 15th month.
Mr. Chair, you're going to where's the law? I'm saying it's the responsibility of the legislature to do the right thing.
Point of order. I want to make sure that I recognize Representative Olson. Unless I recognize you, please don't speak. So, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate this. And I know that Representative Knorr has carried the bill. We have a UI Trust Fund bill moving. I think we're all committed to the work. I just want to say that before I have a question, actually, but just in response to the comments made, that the only really deadline that we actually had that was beyond just our word was to the frontline workers. We said we'd have that done on Labor Day, and we didn't. And so that is, we it's a workforce committee, and we're talking about workforce shortage, what we went through the last 2 years. And so I just want to bring us back that that was more than our word, and we're way past due. And so we can, I've said it in my other committee today, we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and we need to have the conversation about workers too. But I'm actually going to pivot a little bit away from that into the budget that we saw today, which has to do a lot with what we're talking about. There's a big portion of it for the UI Trust Fund, and we're having that conversation, and there were other pieces that were highlighted today through the testimony. And Commissioner Grove, you and I worked a lot on this and have seen some really good things come to fruition around childcare, which was a really big thing. It's kind of the number one thing. I know even he didn't testify it today, but the APEX, Mr. Hansen and I have had many conversations around business growth and what it takes in, especially in greater Minnesota, it's childcare and it's housing. And so if you could speak a little bit about the childcare funds you have used before, the type of demand, and I know it's not currently in your budget, but what you could see moving forward around the needs for childcare and how we could potentially partner on that, even though it maybe wasn't in your budget at this point. And again, why priorities matter. And if we spend a bunch of money on UI, it's harder to put into your budget the childcare. So also want to note that this is a reflection of that. And I say childcare is super important and want to just hear a little bit more about how that fits into how DEED thinks about workforce.
Commissioner Grove.
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, I could not agree with you more. And, you know, this has been a major priority of the governor, lieutenant governor, since they came into office. And really, thanks in large part to your leadership and partnership on this, we've been able to do some pretty historic things. I mean, you advocated for, and we all worked together to pass this last budget, some historic childcare funding for DEED to help new childcare businesses get started, which is kind of the role that we play in that spectrum. Many of the members of this committee and I have had one-on-one conversations. I've visited your districts. You've shown me childcare facilities that you've helped get started. This is a crisis. We're about 90,000 slots short in the state. We did a childcare economic development grant round last fall. We have another one coming this summer. These are bigger rounds than we've ever done before, which is great. And the governor's budget contains a lot for childcare in the DHS portion. The focus that we've made this time is really on that subsidy and CCAP rate component of the spectrum, which is important. But I'll tell you this, you know, every time we put money into the market through the program that we have for economic development for childcare, it creates thousands of new slots. So we have a lot moving on this front. I'll bring it back to that Minnesota Business Vitality Council that's also in our budget. Its latest sprint, which we'll be issuing in the next week or two, is focused on childcare in particular and new ways, new innovative solutions that we need to partner between public and private sector on this topic. Really excited to share that with all of you. And if we can fund that office as a part of this budget, we can do more sprints like that. They can create meaningful recommendations for us to build parts of our economy that are going to help our workforce grow. So thanks for the question and for your leadership on this, Representative Olson. I appreciate it.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I just want to note, like, I think we're focusing on one part, but there are so many demands for around workforce and in what we need to do right now to invest in workers, and just wanted to bring it back there. And that's a major component and a big focus and a big priority. We had our Duluth St. Louis County Days down at the Capitol last week, and that was a big portion of that. And just wanted to note that, especially in this committee, not just in the Early Childhood and Early Learning Committee. So thank you.
Representative Franke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. Thank you, Commissioner Grove, for the presentation. Of course, I'm going to hit the UI stuff a little bit, but I was wondering if you could explain to me, Commissioner Grove, how does the UI fund or system affect state and local government or nonprofits? Do they pay into the system? A lot of what we do here at this committee is work within the agencies to help provide jobs, work with a lot of these nonprofits, fund them, hand that money out. Do they pay into the unemployment system?
Commissioner Gore.
Sure, Nora, Representative Franke, great question. So there are two types of payers in the state's unemployment insurance system. There are taxpaying employers, which is about 130,000, and there are reimbursing employers, which there's around 3,000. And state and local governments and nonprofits generally fall into that second bucket of a reimbursing employer. To answer your question is yes, they do pay into the system, but in a different way. They do a sort of pay-as-you-go model where when they lay off workers, they pay for those workers. The money does go back into the trust fund. Much of those dollars, thanks to the action of this committee and the Senate and the governor over the pandemic, were forgiven, given those layoffs were almost all, or at least largely, due to the pandemic. But it is a slightly different system. But yes, everyone pays in. Everyone's a part of the system that creates that social safety net for our workers.
Representative Frank.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Grove. So state and local governments and a lot of nonprofits, they were absolved from, having to pay extra. I'm going to make 2 points, and I will try not to belabor this too much. When it comes to our word on the frontline workers, we passed that bill out of the House. Also, our original word on that bill was $250 million. So we've held up to that word, and as a body, the House has actually increased that to $1 billion. So, that's where the House stands on that. Getting back to our word on unemployment, businesses over the last 2 years, time and time and time again, 2 weeks to flatten the curve. Now we need to shut your business down. Now you have to have limited capacity. Sorry you have to lay your workers off. Sorry you have to bust your butt just to try and pay your bills, but you will not be held liable. On top of it, government will take care of your employees, and we will take care of you. And here we sit once again, and the mindset of a small business owner is, this is abusive. It's abusive, members, to the small business owner. And if you don't think that people out in your community are feeling the same way, and I know that the DFL leadership and some members want to be like, it's a tax cut to big business. 70% from the administration, 70% of businesses in Minnesota are small businesses. We're the ones that are going to be impacted. The Targets, the Walmarts, the ones that were allowed to be open, the ones who made billions of dollars over the course of the pandemic, they'll be fine. They'll raise the price of toothpaste a couple of pennies, but your small businesses, they're struggling right now, and this is going to hurt them, members. One more question, if you would, Mr. Chair.
Yes, proceed. I know I see 3 more hands, and we've got 3 minutes. Go for it, and then we'll see how we can adjust the time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to get off of that soapbox. Commissioner Grove, I just want to thank you for all your hard work in administering the UI. One question I have you guys considered looking into the hospitality industry? I know a lot of what we talked about today was around technology and expanding and helping and attracting workers and bringing in systems to help grow Minnesota. But I hearken back to a presentation we had a couple weeks ago that the cooking industry and other industries within the hospitality industry, that one of the largest needs is cooks. It was like the highest job in demand. Have you guys given any thought to putting some type of funding other than the few small programs like Representative Baker has championed with ProStart and others to maybe make this more of a hospitality hub in Minnesota to also attract not only business, but maybe work hand in hand along with, anyways, I'll just end there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Grove.
Mr. Representative Frankie, indeed. And, I think several of you and I have visited businesses over the last year and a half. We've been hit by this pandemic, and hospitality has been hit the hardest in so many ways. We have a dynamic new director of Explore Minnesota Tourism, Laura Benton McGinney, who is a great leader for that organization. There's a lot of money we've gotten into the hands of hospitality so far through our grant programs. And we're talking about a lot of other ways to support it. So I couldn't agree with you more. We've been working a lot with Hospitality Minnesota on just what that industry needs right now. And part of this overall message of marketing Minnesota has that halo effect of affecting tourism too. The more we can invite people in town and business to our state, there's reverberations into tourism as well.
Representative Cotizza-Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for being with us again today. I have
a couple questions, and I've got so many thoughts. It's kind of hard to gather everything. But one of the comments that you had made about there's funding in the budget for a website. Is it Join Us MN? That's like to recruit employees from other states potentially. Okay, I see you nodding. Thanks. I don't have to pause for that. But yeah, so my kind of ties into my other thought of I was doing a little bit of research on this frontline worker bonus pay and how many other states have given money to their frontline workers. I didn't see any of our surrounding states on those lists. I mean, there was everything from Missouri to Vermont to Kansas and a bunch of other states. And there was East Coast, West Coast, kind of all in between. But I didn't see any like North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin on that list. And so one of the things that was coming to my mind was if we could get the deal done on frontline worker bonus pay, since we're way past the deadline on that, that really tells workers from out of state that Minnesota cares about you. And you put your lives on the line. We are going to support you. We are going to get bonus money back in your pocket, and none of the other states in the Midwest, in this northern Midwest region, have done that. So I think that that's something that we really could do, and we should make sure that we light the fire on that and get that done. Secondly, I was curious if you have, for the sake of the public and those of us, those of them tuning in today, do you have any average numbers that could just kind of help people grasp a little bit what these percentages look like to an average business of like, if somebody has 5 employees? I mean, because my understanding is that it's roughly less than $100 a month. And so obviously if they have 5 employees and they're gonna pay $100 a month per employee, that's $500. It would look like Target something very, very different because they have hundreds of employees, thousands of employees perhaps. So I'm just curious, like for the size of a business, do you have dollar amounts for people to wrap their heads around?
Commissioner Grove, and I may share something after that. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Bernard, Representative Kizumatun, thank you for those questions. Yes, on average, we estimate that businesses, if these tax increases kick in and we do not replenish the trust fund, will pay about 30% more in UI taxes than they usually do. That's on average. Now, it can vary based on what's called your experience rating, which means how much you actually use the program and some other factors. But you're right, it does scale up. Bigger businesses will pay more, smaller businesses will pay less, but on average, about 30% increase. And just to put it in perspective, and the governor and I were in St. Cloud on Friday and met with a small business owner there on Main Street who told us that if these UI taxes go into effect, she will have to stop paying for parking for her employees because that's the trade-off she'll have to make. So this is something that employers are paying attention to and thinking about the trade-offs with these costs at the time they're challenging. And I think that's important to keep in perspective. I could not agree with you more on frontline workers. I think that when you look at our state's economy, the largest gap in our job vacancies right now is in the healthcare sector. We're 40,000 job vacancies in the healthcare sector in Minnesota right now. Passing frontline worker pay is a tremendous way to show other people that we care about our workers in these industries that have sacrificed so much. And as a member of the frontline worker panel last summer, who heard countless stories, many of them quite painful and difficult to hear and very real about the struggles that workers went through during the pandemic, I could not agree more with you that passing $1 billion for frontline workers is incredibly important, not only because it's the right thing to do, but it does show others around the nation that this is a state that takes care of its workers and then is committed to creating a really strong healthcare sector.
Thank you so much, Representative Kutuzotun. I just wanted to put on the record the actual amounts as I share with you. I don't know if you can see the screen there. With 6 employees, the actual payment without the changes that we're looking into is 7,068. If the changes take into effect, it's going to be 9,000. That puts a per employee per quarter at $91. So that's on 30%, as the commission has already stated. It's on the record. That's the change that we see. It's $1 a day when you have an experience rating of 3%. As you go up, the percentage increases go down. We know that, but the payments also change. So members, that's what we're looking at. If there will be change, we will be able to mitigate. We do have a bill already to address that issue, and we're looking forward to make sure that the Senate Republicans are willing to stand with us and support us. So that's the record that I wanted to put, and everybody should know exactly what it means for employers. Lead Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, first of all, I'll give credit where credit is due. When it comes time to support the frontline workers, the majority party in the Minnesota House did put an emphasis on this and passed a bill that was $1 billion passed the Minnesota House. You've done your job there. You passed that bill out of there. Now let's talk about the UI Trust Fund. You had mentioned, Mr. Chairman, that it's not a law, but that date on March 15th is important. It's so important. The commissioner sent out a text at 3:46 p.m. on the 11th of March stating why it's very important. So what I would like to do is ask the commissioner one more time, share with this committee why March 15th is so important for the governor and the department on getting this bill passed by March 15th. So Commissioner Grove, if you would answer that question, please.
Commissioner Grove, and then we'll end up with Chair Dunn.
Chair Noor, Representative Hamilton, you're right. March 15th is important. It's an administrative hurdle that we see is really critical to making sure we can make the changes you would ask us to make if, in fact, you pass these changes. We already have employers that have been submitting their tax information and paying that higher tax rate. This starts to really increase dramatically after March 15th, and we know that from observing decades and decades of payment activity in our employment insurance system. Every day after March 15th, this thing gets a lot harder to unravel. And to go back and fix this in the back end is going to create a ton of confusion for businesses and be an extraordinary administrative burden that could take months to iron out. And so that is why March 15th is a critical date to pass this package. And we hope that we're able to do so.
Just wanted to add one more thing. Commissioner Grove, if it's possible, can you share with this committee the deposits that we made last year in the month of March so we know exactly how much we anticipate to see because it's a cycle. We know that people pay. And also for the month of April so we know when the actual deposits took place. Based on the memos that I have, almost all the employers have been waiting for the last date. Unless we're holding back the funds, those two, I want to put that on the record. That we need to see the deposits at the statement. Lead Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, not only did we pass a frontline worker bill off the House floor, we have not even passed a UI trust fund bill out of committee. We passed it out of this committee, but it's still sitting in Ways and Means. We haven't even heard this bill on the House floor yet. You know, and the deadline, like we'd said, the commissioner stressed the importance once again why March 15th is so important, Mr. Chairman. We have to do this and we should be doing it today. Mr. Chairman, I hope you and your leadership will declare an urgency on the House floor today. Bring this forward. Let's get it passed. Let's do the right thing for the people of the state. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, can I respond to your ask of me a moment ago? That'd be okay?
Yes, Mr. Commissioner Grove.
Thanks, Chair Noor. We're happy to discuss any data that might be helpful here that's the extent we have it available. On the point of sort of the timing of this, I just want to make an extra point on this. We have 130,000 employers in the state. This is also an administrative burden to make those changes in our system. This has to be done on an employer by employer basis. So there is a huge internal hurdle for us to make these tax change shifts if we're going to, because right now we are loaded up with a previous tax rate. It's kind of like asking TurboTax at the last minute to refigure the taxes of an individual consumer. You could never do that just with a flip of a switch. And so that's a piece of this that I don't want to get lost in this conversation.
To that, Commissioner Grove, when we sent the determination letter, based on my conversation with many employers and those who used the IT systems to do their payment, they've already uploaded the changes because they anticipate that's the high rate they will be paying and it's coming from them. But first, they need to submit their wage details so that they can analyze how much they have to pay for the UI on a quarterly basis. That's my assumption. And that's my conversation that I've had with many employers who have already set their system to pay the new tax rate for 2022. I just wanted to put that on the record and allow Chair Dovney to close us for the day.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I'll try to be brief, but you know that's not my strong suit. Question for the commissioner first up. Am I recalling correctly that for a significant period of time, maybe even currently, we've held employers harmless from the experience rating changes? Can you help me with the significance of that, the timeline of that and the like, please, Commissioner?
Yeah. Chair Noor, if I may.
Yes, please, Commissioner.
And Representative Devney, yeah, so we, and by we, I do mean we, legislature and the governor last year through executive order and passed law, held employers harmless for the layoffs they made during the pandemic if they're related to the pandemic. It was no fault of their own. We're not going to increase their sort of penalty, if you will. That was relevant through last September, at which point all the federal benefits end. We kind of got back to normal, if you will, for the UI system. So that means that for 2022, experience rates won't go up. So this coming year, we will not see that particular piece of the tax code, which again is complex and involves many different components, but that particular piece this year will not go up. In 2023, it will go up. And that's not something anybody is suggesting we change. A system has to have an experience rating to function properly so that the employers that are laying more people off pay a higher share into the trust fund. But you're right that we did hold employers harmless for the period of the pandemic, and that includes reimbursing employers too.
And,
you know, Mr. Chair, there's as Commissioner Grove knows, if I'm in within 5 feet of him for more than about 30 seconds, I want to start talking about technology and workforce development. And I'll spare him and the committee that we can catch up on the interaction between what the K-12 system could be doing more robustly to get us out of that 50th place in computer science and how that would connect up with the work of DEED. But I did want to just remind members that we have been providing benefits to companies for a long time through the pandemic with that holding the experience rating harmless, and that there should be there. The March 15th is an administrative hurdle. It's not a deadline. It's not a hole we fall into. It's just something we have to work around. And I think that's what, to tie it all together, I think that's what the good Lord made computer programmers for, because they'll recode things to adjust. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Devney. With that, Commissioner, I just wanted to ask the last question. Knowing that this is more about our way or the highway, as other people are putting it, we want to make sure that we support the businesses, we support the workers. In fact, that was how the premium pay was designed under the ARPA funds. Number one, the frontline workers were prioritized in that process. We're willing and ready to sit at the table and bring this to a conclusion, even if it's today. But the Senate Republicans have to really act immediately to come to the table. Two, I just wanted to ask you the question, do we have a contingency plan? Because the system, the law says that any employer can receive a refund or a credit. Do we have the contingency plan if after the fact that we change the law to allow by putting more resources and cutting the rates for the employers, giving them a tax cut?
Chair Noor, if the body delays and at some future date changes its perspective on UI taxes and what the department should do, as I said, we would have to go back and 130,000 times in a row recalculate those taxes, which again could take months. Further complicating this matter, not to get into too much detail, but we don't control the trust fund in the same way that the sort of our state, our Department of Revenue, for example, controls tax accounts. It is held by the federal government. And so we've never had to do this before. We have to figure out some way or another to create some sort of a voucher system for future bills. Again, this is just, it's uncharted territory for us in terms of what that would look like if we don't act now. So we will do what the legislature deems we should do in make things right in the future, but it will take months. It will be complicated. We'll have to figure out a new approach to tackle it. And that is why we are hopeful we can do this by tomorrow and stave off such a complicated set of gymnastics and get this money in the right direction for the future of our economy.
Thank you so much, Commissioner and members, for this important conversation. As we know, it's an administrative hurdle that we are going to be dealing with and not a cliff that we're going to be falling off. So I wanted to thank the commission and all the testifiers for being here today. Chair Dabney, you still have your hand up. Did you have any follow-up? All right, thank you so much. With that, members, no further agenda items. We are now adjourned. Thank you so much.